Hello and welcome back to Mess Explores with Xavier and Alan. This week we're digging into fears of the psyche and resurrection, so take it away, Alan.
Hello, Save, and of course, hello to our favourite fans. Welcome back to Mess Explores. Before we tame the monsters of our past and question the growth of a baby, our podcasts are best enjoyed if you've seen the film prior, as we do contain spoilers. Now, Save said, we are looking at Resurrection, which is a 2022 psychological thriller film written and directed by Andrew Semmons. The film stars Rebecca Hall, Tim Roth, and Grace Kaufman, just to name a few. So without further ado, Save, let's get straight into the film. What did you think?
I didn't actually know what to expect of this film going into it. It'd sort of been recommended to us, and I didn't watch the trailer for it. I didn't read any reviews about it. I didn't even read the synopsis for it, to be quite honest. And so sort of going into this, I was like, okay, I'm not really sure what to expect from it. I've always sort of had a thing for Rebecca Hall. Most of her roles are sort of, you know, they're quite watchable. I was surprised Tim Roth was in it. I hadn't even looked up who the cast was for this film. So he was a pleasant surprise for this as well. Watching this film, it definitely wasn't my sort of film. I mean, for those that have listened to our podcast, they know I'm not into the gory, scary type of stuff. Now, this not to say that this was a horror film by any stretch of the imagination, but there were certain scenes, and I think you all know which ones I'm talking about, that I was a bit sort of like, that's a bit horrifying. On the whole, though, I think the film was well done. It was an interesting story, and it was done in a relatively compelling and engaging way. So despite, you know, my couple of personal grievances for it, I actually think it was quite a good little film. How about you?
Now, look, this film really surprised me in terms of, you know, like, I was like you. I went into it blind, had no idea what I was anticipating, and then, boom, it just hits you. And I like that crescendo build-up from Act 1 to Act 3. And it was a film that had me thinking, even post-watching it.
Yeah, there was moments in there, and I mean, obviously this was a psychological thriller, and you sort of look at the character of David, played by Tim Roth, and, you know, Margaret, played by Rebecca Hall, and you go, how much of it is, I guess, psychological abuse to a certain extent. It's him projecting control over Margaret by means of, you know, messing with her psychologically about their dead son and claiming this inside. And if you actually think about it and pick it apart at a very psychological base level, you actually realize probably how easy it is to manipulate people of either sex in this kind of way. Now, it doesn't have to be about eating a dead baby, but just by the repetitive actions and abuse and reward mechanisms. And it's a bit like Pavlov's dog, whereby, you know, there is that sort of reward and action that carries on as a result of it. And that behavior then becomes sort of perpetuated and repeated, and you can escalate it. And as we saw with character Margaret, you know, get to the point where she'd stand in poses that were, you know, quite painful, or she'd, you know, burn herself with cigarettes and things like that. And so it was very interesting to look at this outside of the filmic world and go, just how easy would it be for this to occur? And, you know, we hear about this happening, and, you know, particularly in cases of, you know, domestic violence and whatnot, where, you know, sort of the psychological aspect of domestic abuse is starting to come a bit to the fore in terms of legal policies and reforms around those behaviours, to see that this actually can be a very real problem, and that it is very easy to actually manipulate people in this way if you have a certain mindset. And that's a somewhat scary thing, but it's also an interesting topic for discussion.
It's actually funny that you mentioned this, because it was just only yesterday I was watching the news and they were talking about changing the legalities for these type of abusive relationships in terms of persecution in Australia. So I think that was just very eerie for me, because I just watched the film and I'm watching the news and I'm going, oh wow, this is crazy. I want to sort of take this from a perspective of Margaret, because I feel like the film is shot from her perspective the whole way through. And from the very first scene, you know, we noticed that intensity that verges sort of on obsessiveness, and it just creates this uneasy feeling. And I didn't even know how to take, or what stance to take on this character. Like, Margaret is basically the model for, you know, what you can perceive as calculated control. Whether she's at work or she's, you know, like that protective mother, or even see her rigid calculations with her sex life. And, you know, there's this notion of efficiency, and it seems like her pleasure sort of suffers, or her happiness sort of suffers, because of how efficient that she wants to be. And that efficiency ends up prevailing. Now, I don't think Margaret's methods should be misconstrued for her being cold or distant to her family or her friends or her colleagues, but I think it's more that she's constantly on guard and she's always switched on. Now, the reason for that, obviously, as the narrative unfolds, gets unpacked, but I think the director's done a great job just to cement that from the very start.
Absolutely. And I think one interesting part about this film, well, there's a couple of interesting parts, but one part I want to touch on here was about her reality and sort of her lived life and I guess the ramifications of her past and how they were projected into her present, which you just sort of mentioned in terms of that, I guess, somewhat clinical and evaluated nature at which she carries out relationships, both with, you know, sort of sexual partners or her daughter or anything like that going forward. But one element of this film that I was a little bit unsure about, and I don't know if this is open to interpretation or if I've looked at it too deep, but was David real? Or was he a projection within her own psyche? Now, the only reason I ask that is because it's a very sudden pivot. It's like she sees someone in a crowd and she associates it with a memory, perhaps. And then we have later instances where she sees him in the park and he alludes to the fact that, you know, you came up to me. We've already had this discussion. I've introduced myself. Now, was it him messing with her or was she literally just going after someone that she'd seen and projecting her sort of, I guess, mental perception or issues or history onto? And yeah, whether that's right or wrong, I don't think matters because, as you say, the character of Margaret is the focal point. That is the side of the story we hear things from. But likewise, at the very end of the film, we actually see she's in a very different situation. She's got a young child and her daughter is back home. Now, there's a couple of lines in there that, you know, Abby even mentions about essentially the fact that it's almost undone the, I guess, difficulties in their relationships earlier. But it would almost make you suggest, well, was that relationship difficulties that caused Abby to walk out in the first place? Did that actually happen? Was Margaret actually pregnant and she's going through some sort of psychological trauma during her pregnancy? Was David real? Was it all a figment of her imagination? Or did she have a psychological break and she's come out the other side? So I think there's a whole lot of different avenues at which you can actually analyze the character of Margaret specifically and in terms of how it pertains to the circumstances and environment that she exists in and projects on herself and the world around her.
I guess the question that you've asked was the most important question throughout the film, and I think that's the glue that holds this film all together. And look, before I sort of give you my interpretation of this, I sort of feel like the director leaves us with breadcrumbs throughout the narrative. You know, because at first, it's easy to overlook, but as the narrative unfolds, the psychological chaos sort of builds and it becomes insurmountable. And at first you've got the trauma or the perceived anxiety of Abby who's about to leave for college. And then we sort of have this human tooth or molar that sort of is presented in Abby's wallet. And then you obviously have this man who she perceives to see in the lecture room before she starts to freak out. And then we have her daughter's accident, whether or not it's an actual accident or not, you know, it's unclear. And I think it's, you know, it's intentional. But I think that's what the beauty of this film is. You know, you're not meant to be decisive with your opinions. It's meant to be an experience. And I think Simmons actually wants you to take that journey with the protagonist. And, you know, like you raise this great point where is David real? Personally, I don't think he is. I think David represents a manifestation of her past trauma. And she's triggered of every little thing that reminds her of him. And whether or not, you know, she's pregnant now, I definitely believe she was pregnant at the time that she was interacting with David back when she was 18. And, you know, that whole narrative and dialogue that she speaks for 7 minutes, that monologue, that was a very poignant, like, monologue for, as a viewer, how he stepped into her world. Because as she's talking, it's almost like the secondary character of the temp or the intern actually fades away and the background fades to dark. And it's almost like she's talking to you, the viewer. She's telling you her story. And and she wants us to be, you know, engulfed in that world or in her experience.
It's definitely an interesting perspective on it because that monologue scene was very intense, very powerful. It's sort of that one solid shot just looking at her as she just delivers it to us. And I think you're right. It definitely was almost as though we had become the intern and we were getting told the story. But by the same token, I think we were meant to have the reaction that the intern did. It was almost of disbelief. It's like, well, is this story actually true or is this woman completely had a psychological break? Part of me is inclined to say that she probably did have a psychological break and that this may not have actually occurred to her in the past. Now, maybe it did. And I think that's, as you say, that's sort of the question in this film is whether it was real or not. I agree with you. I think David was a projection of some past trauma or a present trauma she was living for reasons perhaps unspecified. And that the projection of the baby inside him was perhaps from the fact that there was a baby inside her. And, you know, I think this is the thing. Psychological manifestations can come out in so many different ways. There is no necessary right, wrong, or formula for the ways in which these occur and how they are lived by people. And likewise, how the people around them deal with it? And I think that was one of the things that we saw with the intern, was that initially the character of Margaret was counseling the intern through the difficulties she was having in her relationship and sort of assisting her to get out of an unhealthy relationship. While at the same time, Margaret does a 180 degree pivot within a few days potentially, and suddenly is the one that is trapped in a seemingly dysfunctional relationship of the highest order, but no one else can see it. It's purely lived by her.
Mm. And I think you're right, Zay, because that monologue was a perfect setup for that ending that was so ambiguous. You know, like, you just sort of end up going, whoa, what the hell just happened here?
Mm.
And, you know, and the monologue, she talks about the cost of kindness, and we hear this word throughout the film, kindness, but in this specific context, kindness actually ranges from, you know, housework to humiliation to subjugation to self-harm, you know, like to prove her devotion to David at one point, you know, like it's got so much stress positions that this one word actually means, and it's all manifested and all amalgamated into this one word that she carries since she was 18 up until she's, you know, an adult now.
Mm.
One of the most interesting things I've noticed when talking about Margaret is how her physical appearance deteriorates from the start of the film to the very end of the film. Initially, you've got this, you know, very prim, proper dressed Margaret. And then over time, her clothes are very ratted. They're untucked. They're sweaty. Her hair is disheveled. It's this slow deterioration over the hour and a half time frame that we see from a very well-kept and well-mannered Margaret to a very erratic and just, you know, disheveled character.
And that's an important point, though. And I think, again, that comes back to that inner psyche. It's, you've become so consumed by matters within yourself that you fail to act on those outside of yourself. And it's probably something that's, you know, not an uncommon occurrence. And I think it still comes back to the fact, though, that the characters in the film outside of Margaret, they could see the fact that she was coming apart. They could see the fact that she was becoming disheveled and frazzled and losing sight of perhaps what was important in terms of their perception of it. But because they had no concept of what was going on for her other than these crazed manic, oh my God, there's David, we have to run, like run, get home, lock yourself in your room type of nonsense. We essentially got the perception of a crazy woman, because whether what was happening to her was purely in her own mind or not, nobody else could actually see it for what it was, and she couldn't convey clearly to anyone else what the issue was, because it just came across as that sort of manic psychosis whereby she was so caught up in what the issues were, she couldn't express them to anyone else. She almost expected this blind trust and absolute compliance to ensure everyone's security. But the fact that she couldn't actually express that in a valid and tangible way without getting defensive about it, for me, reiterated the fact that it probably was something internal, and it was a self-defense mechanism of her own psyche and the issues that it was creating, and ultimately, you know, led to her pushing away her sexual partner and pushing away Abby and all the sort of relationships around her, her work, and all those things we would consider to be a healthy, normal part of life.
Well, one interesting fact, Save, is we actually don't see David interact with any of the other characters. It's always Margaret, which leads me to believe that, you know, he's just a manifestation of her trauma or her past trauma. And there's lines in the film where her daughter's like, oh, it's happening again, or you're sort of losing the plot again. And then her partner's like, you know, you need help. And like these little small lines, it's almost like, hey, has this happened before? Is this the first breakdown that you've had? Or is this something that happens more frequently that the viewer is not actually aware of?
And I think the extension of that too is that this past trauma that she claims to have lived, whether it was true or not, it took place in a closed environment. You know, she mentioned the fact that her hippy-dippy parents had known David at the time, and that they just kind of left her be, and she ended up with remaining with David in the middle of nowhere to live a life of isolation and, I guess, to some extent, I guess, you know, domestic depravity. But there was no witnesses to that, and likewise, you know, no apparent record of this child being murdered or eaten, and, you know, two fingers being left behind and whatnot. So a lot of her bold claims remained unsubstantiated and, I guess, to some extent unverifiable. Presumably her parents were no longer on the scene, or they'd passed away or whatnot, which sort of reiterated the fact that a lot of this probably had occurred solely within her own mind. Now, what trauma she was projecting on why, or whether there had been a trauma previously, or she was just having a, I guess, a psychotic moment, it's hard to say. It's not really for us as the audience to to engage with one way or the other to say this is definitely what was occurring. But it really does reiterate the fact that it probably wasn't real.
Yeah. And, you know, most of this film can be seen through the lens of Simmons' exploration of domestic violence, like we've already previously mentioned. But I think the awful reality, or the very hard reality, is the fact that what happens to victims when they report abuse, you know, like, we've got family who don't understand a story that's, like you just said, too horrid to be readily believed, you know, like a person's behavior just can't, you know, just deteriorating and becoming so erratic that it actually discredits them from the truth, albeit, you know, that might be actually the truth.
And I feel like this is what they were trying to convey, particularly through the first instance of reporting it to the police, where she was saying, you know, this character David was sort of following her, or that she was concerned about him and that they'd been abusive in the past and so on and so forth. And the police were sort of the angle, well, that may well be so, but if he hasn't actually done anything to you now, he's not engaging with you, he hasn't hurt you, and he hasn't come near anyone else, then there really is nothing we can do, because essentially it's pure conjecture at that point. And as we see through Abby and Margaret's sexual partner and whatnot, they don't know what to do with her either. Now, whether that's because there is truly nothing they can do because David isn't a physical problem that can be solved, or if it's just inside her own mind. But I wouldn't have been surprised if at the very end of this film, we saw her in a straight jacket sitting in the corner of a room rocking back and forth, because it felt very much like that's where this film was heading. And the fact that we got that very glitzy, clean, everything's okay ending where she's got the baby and her daughter's returned was very much at odds with the rest of the narrative of the film. And I think that would suggest that she'd found, I guess, that inner peace, but I don't think it was a true inner peace. I think, again, it was another manifestation of massively psychological proportions that was, I guess, the equal and opposite power or magnitude of what she had experienced on the flip side with the negative version of David. So it was an interesting outcome there.
Well, I think having the ending or the final act as her in, you know, being in a straitjacket would have been slightly cliche.
Oh, but 100%.
I can definitely see why we would have thought, because it would have given us a very definitive answer. But I think the ambiguous ending where, you know, she's sort of like, is this real? Is this whole room actually happening, you know, with her daughter holding her son? But I think the most important part of that ending that, you know, that you sort of like, that leaves you wondering is that final erratic fear at the very end before it cuts to black. Because the killing of David, or I guess I can say her version of her killing David, is obviously a happy ending. But it isn't just that black and white, because it's the death of her abuser and her recovering her lost life and her lost inner peace. Mm. But that final moment when she becomes slightly erratic again, or at least exhibits fear, shows, hold on a second, you know, this could be something that's just sort of, she can never escape from. Because just like the baby lived for all these years, and this is the metaphorical take on this, and finally survived, maybe David, even after gutting him, can also survive in her. Because the baby represents what she lost and what she wants to regain. And I think David represents what she wants to lose and what she wants to sort of kill. But they both haunt her equally. And it's just so, you know, that dynamic is so complex, but it's symbiotic.
Mm. And I think that symbiosis is the important part here, because even if you just took the baby as, I guess, a perception of innocence, from a psychological standpoint, the baby is also a binary tether between her and David, if it were a real thing. And I think that was where you would find, from a psychological standpoint, David would live on, because he would live on in the baby, because it is something that actually tied them for all eternity to one another.
Yeah.
And I guess that sort of resonates with your idea that David could, you know, come back, that he could be reborn in some way. And it would be the fact that she always has that, I guess, tether or connection to him through the baby that they apparently shared.
Yeah. One thing that was, the acting in this film was just phenomenal. Rebecca Hall and Tim Roth are just phenomenal in this film. But just as equally phenomenal was the background score. Like, that itself, you know, was another character. I think it was Jim Williams who's responsible for the music. Man, that background score just cultivated this film to another level, and it sort of took on its own personality.
It's funny you say that, because I actually can't really remember any of the score for this film. Now, maybe it's because I was absorbed in, I guess, the psychological drama. And as I've said in previous podcasts, I feel like if you don't necessarily notice music, then it's probably done its job well, because it's helped amplify your engagement and heightened your senses in a scene without it becoming an overt sort of element of the film. And I guess to some extent I do recall that, particularly in those times of tension, it really did resonate and add to that feeling. And likewise, the absence of sound, I think, was equally an important thing at times in this film. But yeah, I guess I can't talk too much more than that, because I think the score did exactly what it was meant to do, and it heightened the film without becoming overt in its own right.
All right, Zave. Well, with that being said, I think that was a very short and sweet summation of, like, a really good film that, you know, I think it did well at the Sundance Festival.
I actually can't recall, to be honest. I haven't even looked up how successful it was.
Yeah. I think it was the talk of the town.
Well, there you go. Very, very deservedly. I mean, short and sweet film that wasn't at all sweet, but there you go. But that's all from us again this week, folks, and thanks for listening. Remember to follow us on your favourite platforms and channels, and keep the suggestions coming for films you'd like us to review too. But until then, we'll see you in a fortnight.
Don't forget to like, follow and subscribe, and we'll see you all soon.